The Wire.
How you going?
The Ballot Build-Up on 95BFM.
Yes, as part of our ballot build-up, there are only 2 days to go until the election. Today we are joined in studio by the leader of the ACT Party, David Seymour. Hello, David. How are you going today?
Yeah, good day. I'm doing great. Nice to be in the studio.
Welcome.
I think this studio is where I did my first ever radio interview as a pimply-faced ACT on campus president.
This is your first time here as ACT leader, though. So welcome. It's taken you a long time to pop in. It's the last week of the election. It's an interesting time to come to give us a visit.
Yeah, well, I think most of the ones I've done with you guys have been on the phone because I've been in Wellington or running around.
Right,
but
right.
Nice to have a time, even in election week, to come in and see BFM.
Yeah, no, it's great to have you here. So this week at The Wire, we're looking at livability in New Zealand. Today we're looking at transport in particular. I thought I'd just briefly touch a little bit on ACT's transport policy. I mean, how much of a priority is transport to ACT?
Well, it's huge because it is interlinked with housing. Basically, the housing problem is that people can't get homes that work with their commute. There's the price of the house, but there's also the price of getting to the places that you need to go. So you can't really solve housing without solving transport. And what I'd say is that, you know, the biggest problem that we have is that we charge people exactly the same to go on the roads, no matter what vehicle they're in or no matter what time of day. And what we need to start doing is following Stockholm and London and Singapore and actually charging at different times. So if you're a person that's getting in a bus with 50 other people, you're doing your bit to save road space. There should be a saving for that. At the moment, you end up stuck behind 50 single occupancy vehicles who are paying the same as you, and I think you're getting ripped off.
Yeah, so I've seen that you've got an encouragement policy, or a policy to encourage ride sharing. I mean, how feasible is it to just have this sort of encouragement? Is there much of an incentive here?
Well, the thing about ride sharing is that it's just a really obvious thing to do that doesn't cost anything. I'll give you an example. I was up at Massey Albany a couple of weeks ago, and they've reserved this huge car park right in front of the main doors for people who ride share. So if you have more than one parking pass, you put two in the dashboard and they'll let you park there. There were two cars in it, and I don't even know if they were, you know, following the rules. What we've said is, look, if you want to use the power of apps that geolocate to start sharing rides, and look, Uber's probably the best known one, but there's also Chariot, there's also Lyft. You know, I'd like to see everybody who drives into Massey, for example, and it's a high proportion of the students there given the location of it, having an app where they can pick up someone and give them a ride. Now, the biggest impediment, and make some money and reduce congestion and reduce emissions all at the same time, and it's win-win-win. The big impediment to it is that right now, if you want to do that, if you want to share a ride for money, you've got to go through $1,500 of government tests and fees, none of which make you any safer than if you were driving someone not for money, and none of which are going to give better feedback than you get from the feedback of an app. So it's just a small example of how you could use technology to increase the number of people per vehicle, reduce congestion, reduce emissions.
But is there much of an incentive here in terms of how to implement the policy?
Well, I mean, the incentive is that you could actually make money if you're driving roughly on the same route anyway. Why not pick up an extra $10 or $20 for driving in? That's the incentive. I can see a transport revolution happening technologically, but government regulations are holding it back. Now, you put that in combination with road pricing, and suddenly you're thinking, okay, well, it's, you know, getting more expensive to drive at peak time. How do you do that? Well, you know, some people, not everyone, it's about choice, will actually do that by saying, well, you know, it's going to be more economical if I actually pick up someone else in my neighbourhood and take them there. Now, maybe only 10% of people will ever do that, but if you could reduce traffic by 10%, that's basically what happens every time we have school holidays.
Right, so you've been talking a lot about housing this week. It's been a major issue, even the defining issue. You've said that you can't afford to buy a house in your own electorate. You're on a 190K government salary. Does this feel like a bit of a fuck you to those who can't earn a fraction of what you do and are looking to get into the housing market?
No, it's not that at all. And let me be clear about how this comes out. You know, when you're a member of parliament, you don't get the same privacy as other people get. So everything I own goes out in an annual return. everyone knows what I earn. That's on a website. And so people started asking me, well, why don't you own a house? And all I've said is, well, actually, because I live in the Epsom electorate, it's probably the most expensive place in New Zealand, so I accept that. But you know, basically, you've got a house that is 10 times my income that I rent with two flatmates. And I'm not saying fuck you to anybody. What I'm saying is the situation has got so ridiculous that actually it's pretty hard for me to do it where I live. It's actually just about impossible for most of our generation to afford homes, because remember, 10 times your income, well, that's the situation that we face at the average wage and the average house price in New Zealand, actually worse than that. It's the average household income in the average house. So, you know, I would say that we've got a major housing problem, and that's where I differ from my coalition partners in National. They have denied that there's a problem for far too long.
You know, there's no denying that there's an issue. We've got people living in cars. I mean, so we had a question on Twitter. How will tax cuts be helping you and others to afford deposits on houses in a suburb like Epsom?
Well, I mean, you know, obviously if you get to keep more of your money, then you can spend more of it on stuff you want, and a lot of people want housing, but I don't think that's
But a housing really, deposit's quite a lot of money.
Yeah. I don't think that's really the answer. The problem with housing is not tax. The problem with housing is that we just aren't building enough homes. So, like, you look at how many homes were built in Auckland last year, 6,000. Completely pathetic. I mean, in 1974, we built 39,000 homes nationwide. That's twice as many as we're building nationwide in New Zealand today, even though we've got 50% bigger population and much better technology for building stuff. So, you know, what you've got to do is say, look, how is it possible that one of the most sparsely populated countries on earth actually has a shortage of land you're allowed to build on? The red tape, the regulations, the planning laws that we've adopted in the last 30 years have, if you want to talk about a big fuck you, well, that's one to our generation. It basically said, yep, we're going to stop building homes and you guys are going to pay inflated prices.
But ACT have been part of this government of the last 9 years that have been, that have, you could say, are responsible for this crisis that we're in. How have you not done anything so far to assist?
Well, I've been in Parliament for 3 years, and not a day goes by that I haven't said, number one, you've got to free up land. Number two, you've got to fund infrastructure properly, and the way that we would do that is to share half the GST on construction with the local council for local infrastructure, because at the moment the council gets none of the revenue from construction, but they're expected to provide all the infrastructure, and that's not fair. Obviously the big problem is there's one of me, and it's pretty hard for one person to change the direction of the government. But the proposition for people out there who are thinking, look, I don't know if I want to pay all Jacinda Ardern's taxes, but I do want to improve the housing market, and I think the Nats have been pathetic on this, is give your party vote to ACT and send the signal that way.
But I mean, Labour have incentives with taxpayers' money to build more houses.
That's not actually what they've said. What they've said is that they're going to create a fund to roll over the capital. So they use that money to finance it, then they sell the house and it recycles. That's their idea. But Labour's real problem is that if you want to build more homes, you know, finance is one thing you need, but you also need builders. And we've got a massive shortage. You can talk to anyone in the construction sector, major labour shortage. You also need land. You know, 700 grand a section in many parts of Auckland. That's a major problem. And that's why we're building two big houses and we're not building affordable homes. Who's going to build a $120,000 house on a $700,000 section? So only the top end of the market's being served due to the land shortage. And then you need to fund infrastructure, because there's no point freeing up land if you don't have the pipes and roads and so on to go to it. So, you know, if Labour knew how to solve all those problems, and ACT actually has strong proposals on all of them, then why would the government need to build houses? Why wouldn't they just, you know, allow everybody to free up land, build infrastructure and build more homes? But of course, you know, they've got this philosophy that the only way to solve problems is for the government to do it. And, you know, you seem to believe that they're going to use taxpayer money to build homes. That's not true. That's not even their proposal.
Okay, you have been calling National a little bit visionless here for looking with how they're going to be dealing with the housing crisis. Why? Tell me a little bit about this.
Well, it's been clear for 9 years, and I'll give you that I think that in the first term of this government, my predecessors in ACT should have gone harder on this, but the Nats ultimately have decided to keep this dirty but open secret, that the average National Party MP owns 2.2 homes, and governments generally get re-elected when property prices rise. So they've been more than happy to watch this happen and introduce really what amounts to tinkering, you know, special housing areas, municipal development fund. None of it's actually made any difference, but they've been able to say they're doing something while quietly letting prices rise. And I think that's a real shame, but I actually think that the way to elect a government that's fiscally responsible, that won't crash the economy with extra taxes, and yet give a kick up backside on housing, is to give your party vote to act.
Is this negativity towards National not a little bit counterproductive to the working relationship that you have?
Well, if I agreed with them on everything, I'd just join the National Party. But actually,
well, no, but they are still in contention for the Ipsum seat. I mean, do you feel 100% safe in that Ipsum seat criticising them?
Yeah, absolutely, because people in Ipsum actually agree that they want a national government back. They think I've been a good local MP for the most part, and they also agree that National has dropped the ball on housing. So they're sitting there saying, you know, happy my house might be worth $2 million. I know that doesn't help me, because if I was to, you know, sell it, I'd just have to buy again in the same market. My real issue is I've got three kids, and I don't know how they're going to get a 20% deposit on an average house price of $1 million in this city. I don't want my kids to be moving away to Tauranga or Hamilton or Dunedin. I want our family to stay together, but the way the Auckland housing market's playing out, there's a very real chance they won't.
Right. Just moving on. So you've been carrying around a wheelbarrow of cash. So we've got these $20,000 notes with your face on them instead of the coins. We've got some right here in front of us. So we're talking a performance pay for teachers under an Act policy. Tell me a little bit about what we've got.
Yeah, so look, I've been Under Secretary for Education for the last 3 years, and I've been responsible for charter schools, and they've done amazing things, just 10 of them, but they've done amazing things for the kids that have gone there. Kids that, you know, weren't even attending school previously, kids that had failed NCA Level 1 and NCA Level 2, coming out and getting A's and B's at this university. That's a real success, but how do they do it? We gave them total flexibility of funding, and most of them chose to economise on their buildings. They don't really have big sports fields and big flash buildings. They put most of their money into paying good teachers more. And so I've said, look, you know, what's the data? When I started school, actually a bit before that in 1985, the teaching were getting 1.93 times the average wage. Today it's about 1.37 times. So that's effectively a 30% pay cut relative to the average wage that teachers have had in the last 30 years. It's turned into a crisis. I represent the Ipsum electorate, as you say, where lots of principals and boards of trustees are saying, we just can't get teachers. We put out advertisements. We used to get 60 applications. Now we get, you know, four, and none of them are any good.
So you think that having some sort of performance pay is an answer?
Well,
to that.
First of all, we've got to deal with the fact that they've fallen behind so far in the last 30 years. So we've said, look, $1 billion increase, that's an average of $20,000 per teacher. That would take the average teacher salary from 73 to 93. Where the performance part comes in is that I think the reason teacher salaries have been so suppressed is there's people out there who think they're good teachers that are part of the community, part of whānau, really worth their weight in gold. And people can't believe how little they get paid for the value that they add in the job that they do. There's other teachers, frankly, that should have been moved on a long time ago. Under the current union arrangement, you have to pay them all the same. No other profession would tolerate it, but that's what's been forced on teaching for the last 100 years. Our view is that teaching as a profession is not that different from law or accounting or engineering or architecture or any of the things that people say teaching should be compared with. So we'd say, look, we're going to give the money to the principal, and they are going to be responsible for hiring, recruiting, and setting pay rates. That's how independent schools do it. That's how school systems in other parts of the world do it. That's how we should be doing it, to make sure we get the best people. People at this university, if you went out in the quad right now and asked how many people are thinking about teaching, I guarantee you it would be dismally low. We want people to say, you know, if I become a teacher, I'm really good. There's no cap on what I could get paid. The sky's the limit. We should have some of our best teachers who are, you know, mentors to other teachers in the school, who are inspirational, might be getting $120,000. That's what the profession should be.
But do you not think that There are risks there that teachers are going to be inclined to move to more affluent areas where there perhaps are students that are going to be doing better.
Yeah.
Or maybe that they're going to be moving to schools that are achieving better results.
People worry about that, but that's a misconception. Like, I'm glad you asked that, because that's a misconception about what we're proposing. So it's not going to be some sort of nationalised, standardised test where if your kids pass all the tests, you get more money. It's going to be based on the way that lots of other professions operate. I mean, you know, I was talking to a project management manager, someone who manages 20 project managers. You know, now she knows that some of them are not really performing, but they've had a hell of a tough time for factors beyond their control, but they're still really valued. There's other people who seem to be doing well, but actually they've just had an easy run. You know, good managers in every other part of the economy can work that out. It shouldn't be any different in teaching. And so we're not talking about giving different amounts of money to different schools. We give the same amount of money to every school. It's about an extra 20 grand per teacher. And then we let the principal work out how best to use it.
Right. So you've criticised Labor's free tertiary study policy. You've called it insidious.
Yep.
What about free tertiary study is insidious?
Very simply, that once you have no skin in the game as a student, the government is setting what you get. They're setting the price, and it'll only take a bit of fiscal tightening, a recession, they'll start reducing the amount that they fund it. All of a sudden the universities say, well, we're going to get rid of the best lecturers, we're going to have bigger classes, and before you know it, you've effectively got an extra 3 years of high school on the end of your other high school. And what will happen is that people that want to go on and differentiate themselves and learn more stuff, the masters will become the new bachelors.
The thing is, though, that this student debt is rife, is rife. I mean, there are students who are just struggling to get off on a starting foot. I mean, and the Labour policy isn't just about university; it includes other tertiary, other tertiary avenues like internships, apprenticeships.
That's fair enough, and we should always make sure that we value, polytechs, apprenticeships, trades training, and so on. Those are actually valuable routes. But one of the things I'd say is that because we've put so much cash into universities, it's been subsidised so heavily for so long, we've actually neglected those other areas. Now, what I would say is, yes, student debt is rife, but here's a couple of thoughts for you. The government doesn't have any money other than what it's going to tax you in the future. So you're going to pay for your education one way or another. The question is, do we have an education system where students have skin in the game, or do we not? The second issue I'd put to you is that the average student debt, last time I checked, was in the high 20s coming out of tertiary studies. The average house price in New Zealand, not in Auckland, in New Zealand, has gone up 78 grand in the past 3 years. So, you know, I am very worried about people coming out of their studies right now, and that they should be worried about their financial position. But you've got to put into perspective, it's housing costs, taxation costs, and student loan costs, and you're not going to make yourself better off by shrinking the student loan and adding to the tax. And you're not going to make yourself seriously better off until you deal with the housing issue.
Are you standing by your statements where you said that you don't believe te reo should be made compulsory?
No, it definitely shouldn't, and I'll tell you why. I was visiting a school for prize giving at the end of last year, Auckland Grammar, where they had compulsory te reo in third form, and the whole school is singing a tremendous waiata, and they're training the whole school to do a haka. Imagine that, 2,600 people doing a haka. It's just about a New Zealand record. The interesting thing about that is that Grammar has been thinking about this for 5 or 10 years, and they held off doing it until they found the right person to be their department head, and they could find the right teachers, and now they're getting a quality result. If you go out there and say everybody has to do it tomorrow, I guarantee you that you'll get resentment. You'll get poor quality teaching. This, incidentally, is why we need to pay good teachers more. You've already got a teacher shortage. You don't want to add an extra compulsory subject. It's not going to work. And so I think that we're in a fabulous renaissance of te reo Māori in New Zealand. But I don't think that compulsion is the way to achieve.
Do you not think that there should be some sort of starting point and a goal to reach that, having compulsory? I mean, do you not think that... I know that there's the criticism that there are not enough teachers, but in having some sort of starting point to get some more teachers in, to get the teaching in, to teaching the teachers how to teach te reo Māori, is important.
If you think it's important to force people to, you know, be brought up according to your worldview, then yes, you should.
But it's part of New Zealand culture.
well, you know, lots of things are part of New Zealand culture, but I'm not interested in forcing my views of how people should grow up on others. I'm interested in
choice. Do you not think that all New Zealanders should be educated on the history of the colonialism of Aotearoa?
I don't think that it's the government's job to force people to learn certain things. So you might think that you know what the next generation needs to know, and you might think that you're there to force people to think the way that you think is right. I'm in favour of freedom and choice. I want a free society. And what you might find is that if you allow that, you get things like Auckland Grammar, a very traditional school, embracing Te Reo Māori. You might be surprised what people will do if you don't force them, but I'm not interested in using compulsion to conscript other people's kids into my political project, and you shouldn't be either. You should think very carefully about what that really means once you start playing that game.
Finally today, you did have an event at North Harbour Stadium where you claimed other parties want to enslave voters with bribes. Do you stand by this?
Absolutely.
Quite strong language.
Well, it is, because the fact of the matter is that the IRD takes taxes compulsorily, and it will take about 31 stadia worth of taxpayers to pay the tax to pay for Labor's spending promises, for instance. You know, some people think that National are a better option on tax. Actually, they're talking about increasing taxation by 11 North Shore stadia worth of taxation.
Do you not think there's anything to the argument of the economies of scale that you can do exponentially?
You might have to explain that a bit more.
Like in terms of looking at it on like a larger scale here. I mean, do you not think the language is a bit strong? Like, do you think mental health is just a bribe here to the public?
Well, there's obviously things that you're going to say are legitimate expenditures, but you need to get across the scale of what is being promised by these parties. Every election is an advanced auction of stolen goods, in this case paid for with your taxes. The ACT Party said we actually should put another $30 million into finding new ways to deal with mental health. We should be funding things like Lifeline, where I used to be a volunteer myself. I think those are valuable. But, you know, it's not fair for you to say, oh, well, you know, we've got $7 billion of extra spending, and if you don't agree with that, you're against improving mental health. Every party's put forward a budget. And I think it's important people recognise quite how expensive some of these promises are, because you talk to people who are starting a business. Give you a classic example. A couple I met just the other day couldn't afford a deposit for a house, so they started a bakery. Now they live in a bakery. Fantastic stuff. But they said, look, you know, we basically are on a knife edge week to week getting our business started up. If you bring in these tax increases, we're gonski. So that's actually what's at stake. And absolutely, if filling people into a stadium to show just what the scale of these tax increases actually looks like gets the message across, then I think that's a very important part of democracy.
Right, okay, so this information was based on figures obtained by the Taxpayers Union, their weekly Bribometer. When did you first get these figures?
Well, we got them when everyone else got them. They released them the night before, but you know they've been updating it for several months.
Right.
Hard to keep up. There's so many spending promises out there. This is, one of the most bribeful elections that New Zealand's had for a long time. So we had them the same time as everyone else.
You got them at the same time as everyone else, I mean, was North Harbour Stadium cool with you just turning up on such a short notice?
Yeah, actually they were.
I
know you're looking for your big conspiracy here, mate, but actually the way things happen in a campaign is that often you do things with less than 24 hours notice.
Right. Okay. Well, that's all I've got for you today, David. Thank you very much
on in. Thank you. And can I just say to your listeners who are saying, look, I don't want Labor's taxes. I don't want to crash the economy. I do want to build more houses and fix education and transport. You've actually got a third option, and that is to give your party vote to ACT. And there's one more reason we haven't talked about that you might like to do that, is that we're a socially liberal party. I turned down being a minister in order to put assisted dying or euthanasia on the ballot. So if you're socially liberal, you're fiscally conservative, you're worried about housing and education, but you don't want to crash the economy, can I humbly ask that you consider giving your party vote to ACT on Saturday or in the next 2 days if you're voting early?
I'm sure we'd love to talk to you a little bit more about your bill after the election.
Well, I hope so.
Yeah. Thank you very much, David.
Thank you.
The Ballot Build-Up on 95BFM.